You're listening to The Maastricht Diplomat.
Hi there. It is my greatest pleasure to welcome you to a new podcast series of The Maastricht Diplomat. I am your host, Leanne, and I will guide you through this podcast series called 1 Month Abroad. In 3 episodes, we will talk about intercultural experiences, homesickness, language barriers, anything you can and maybe cannot yet imagine will happen when you spend 1 month in a completely different country. In fact, during the next 3 episodes, I will have 5 guest speakers with me who all study global studies at Maastricht University. Just like me, by the way. But don't worry, we are not here to make it all about our program. There's a reason why I invited my peers to come talk on this podcast. The guest speakers went to a field study last autumn as part of our bachelor program, each spending 1 month in a different foreign country, conducting research with fellow students on various topics. In this series, they will give you some insights into what it is like to live in a foreign country for such a long, but at the same time also short amount of time. You will hear 5 speakers representing 5 different destinations. With us today for the first episode are Sofia, who went to Uruguay.
Hi.
And Jacob, who went to Thailand.
Hi.
And next episode, our speakers will be Lily, who went to Mozambique, and Lotte, who went to Cyprus. And finally, you will hear from Anthony in the last episode, who went to Colombia, along with a surprise guest speaker. Before we start, I just want to say a big thank you to you, Sofia and Jacob, for being here. And to you, dear audience, just sit back, grab a cup of tea, or enjoy your little walk to the grocery store, whatever you are doing right now. And I hope you will have fun listening to our lovely first chat on intercultural experiences. All right. Can you briefly present yourself, where you went on a field study, and what your research was about?
Yeah, so my name is Jacob. I went on a field study to Thailand for a month. I picked it because I was very interested in the setting, actually, because we were based in a very rural village in Chiang Mai province. And that really appealed to me because I thought it was an opportunity I likely would not get again. My research was focused on water management policies in the village itself. So making sure that everyone has access to clean water and sort of seeing how the government interacts with these rural indigenous communities. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, same for me, actually. So I'm Sofia. I went to Uruguay, so quite on the other side of the world. We stayed in Montevideo, so in the capital city. And our research focused on human rights and food insecurity. And my group, so there were 2 groups doing different kinds of research. My group focused on how the right to food is shaped by societal and domestic inequalities within Uruguay. And we specifically looked at the women's position or the mother's position and the children's access to food, and because that is where most of the food insecurities are focused. And I learned a lot through the experience, and I'm curious what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, it sounds like very interesting destinations, but also projects. So yeah, I think we probably have a lot of very insightful experiences to talk about. And have any of you been already to your destination country before, or to like a country similar to Uruguay or Thailand?
I have never been to Uruguay itself, but I've been on the Latin American continent before. So I've been to Brazil, and I've stepped foot into Argentina for one day and I like crossed the border. So not really to an extent where I can say, yes, I've made a similar experience. So maybe that, I guess, prepared me for the context, but also not really, because like the countries are so vastly different that I still need a lot of research. And then that research was still not enough to kind of really prepare me for what I was facing. But that is also good, because then I was kind of thrown into the unknown.
Yeah, for me, I had no prior travel experience in Thailand or even Asia. I think the furthest east I had gone prior to then was Poland. So entirely uncharted territory for me. And that's also part of the reason I picked it, because it was so different from what I was, even beyond what I was used to, just like what I had experienced prior.
Mm. Yeah. And you mentioned that you prepared a bit. So you did research, I guess. Did you do anything else? What kind of things did you research before going there?
Well, I tried to get an understanding of what food insecurity in Uruguay means. And I kind of, the research I did was watching some documentaries, but also just reading a lot about food insecurity. And a lot of it is linked to the high inflation rates and the general high cost of living in Uruguay. So it's very expensive also for European standards. And you can imagine if it's expensive for European standards or for us who live in Maastricht, which is also not necessarily a very cheap environment, then it must be even more expensive for the Uruguayans, or it is, because in fact the salaries that I get don't really match the expenses that are expected to pay. So mm-hmm. it's not kind of a, you know, a Switzerland scenario where the salaries are also where it kind of makes sense. And that's where that's what I researched mainly, and I tried to learn some Spanish, or like I already knew some Spanish, but kind of refresh my skills. Because, well, I needed that.
I assume a lot of Duolingo lessons then.
Yeah, indeed.
Very nice. And for you?
Yeah, so I, language-wise, tried for about 1 hour to learn Thai. And then I realized Thai is a very difficult language, especially for a European tongue, and I gave up. But I did, in the end, I managed to pick up a couple words when I was there. Please don't ask me to recite them now.
I was just going to ask.
But besides that, research-wise, yeah, I mean, I read as much as I could also in the pre-departure training. For us, the research topic was very unclear for a long time, so I didn't have the chance to really catch up on the water management policies of contemporary Thailand until I was actually there already, so it was quite late. Culturally, though, I tried as best as I could to prepare myself, but I have to say in hindsight, like, I was really, through my reading, barely scratching the surface of sort of the cultural experience of being there.
Mm-hmm. And then the very first days, I can imagine that first being there is like very different from what it is here. Also, we the PSLA was in November or October, so it was very cold here. And then you go to these countries on the other side of the world. How were the differences? What did you immediately catch up on?
Well, actually, opposite to what we were expecting, it was not so warm when we arrived. So we thought it was going to be like 25 degrees, nice weather. But when we arrived, it was really cold. Like, we were freezing. It was rainy. It was like as rainy as in Amsterdam when we left from the airport. So it was for the first like 1.5 weeks, it was really cold. So that was one of the kind of things that didn't go as expected. But, well, it's the weather, so it's not like the biggest thing. But I guess like one thing that really stuck to me, and I also like adapted to that in a way throughout those 4 weeks, was that time is just seen differently, or like there's a different perception of time in the way that we'd be told, okay, we need to be at the university because we were partnering with the Udala University there. So we were told we should be there at 9 a.m. and we're like, yeah, okay, let's go there. And we walked most of the times because we could take buses, but they were not super reliable. And sometimes we also did towards the end of the stay. But in the beginning, we were very like keen on walking, kind of getting like an idea of the city. But it was like a 40-minute walk, so like a good walk. But anyways, we arrived there at 9, and then we just sit around there for like 30 minutes, 45 minutes, doing nothing, waiting around until everyone arrives. It's super chill. And in the beginning, we also kind of were paired with Uruguayan students. And we just waited super long until they all arrived. And some of them were extremely late, like 2 hours, but it was no issue at all. And we were so confused because we were like, well, we were supposed to be here. I wouldn't be starting. Like, why are we waiting for everyone? But so this was like one of the things that didn't match expectations in a way, or like the first surprises.
And then when the other students arrived so late, what was your reaction? Did you point it out, or did you just like kind of go with it?
Well, at some point we just also started being less punctual.
Okay.
Because we adapted to that and like took it more easy and like arrived like 20 minutes late and people would have still not started, so it was fine. But this kind of mindset change of like deliberately not trying to be on time made a difference. Yeah. Interesting experience. Did you have something like that in Thailand as well?
About the punctuality, less so, because people in the village were very punctual.
I remember.
One funny comment that was made was on our first night there, we woke up because obviously there's, you know, very little protection from noise nor light in these. This is a village of 600 people. It's very small, very rural. So we woke up quite early. And at our sort of assembly, the team leader, who is a local from the village, commented, oh, we're so happy to see that so many of you are so comfortable. We heard many of you slept in even past 6:30. And we sort of looked at each other and we were like, are you serious? Like, this is so, for them, that was incredible that we had such a nice lie-in until 6:30 even on our first night, no less.
When did you arrive?
Like, the night before. Yeah. So in the evening-ish, I'd say maybe 5 to 6 in the afternoon.
Okay.
But we must remember that we didn't, so that wasn't my first day in Thailand. That was just my first day in the village because we flew into Bangkok first. Mm-hmm. So it was actually one of the interesting things about the field study is these changes of environment where the village, again, to emphasize, very small. Bangkok, however, is not very small, actually quite the contrary. I'm from Berlin. I thought I knew what big cities were, but I remember landing and you have these like 6-laned highways that stretch out across the city. And I was driving in the bus to the on the way to the hotel, and I look out the window, and it's just like a, it's like a sea of houses and lights and skyscrapers, and it's really something incredible. I tried to capture on photo, but it doesn't come across. Like, you have to really be there. I don't know if you've ever been in a 10 million plus city before, but it's it's very different. So for me, that was a, it was very, when I said overwhelming, but in a good way, not in a not in a scary way, because it was, it's also a very comfortable city. But yeah, the contrast between that and then 2 days later ending up in this tiny village, it sort of shows the diversity of experiences I got from this trip, and I really appreciated that specifically.
Yeah, but this change in the environment, did it affect in any way how you settled into the village then? I think the village was the part where you spent the most time in, right?
Yeah, so to I can give a very brief overview of the structure. Basically, we had the first day in Bangkok because we had a very long journey. Then we took a night train for 12 hours up to Chiang Mai City, which is the second biggest city in Thailand. Spent a night there, and then we took a bus for about 3 to 4 hours to the village. And then from then on out, it was 5 days in the village, 2 days of the weekend in the city, Chiang Mai. So Chiang Mai is a big city, but not as big as Bangkok. And to answer your question, yes, in a way, it did affect our first impressions of the village, but not necessarily in the sense that it was such a big contrast, but more in the sense of we had been so weary from traveling not only across the world, but also across all of Thailand by train, no less, that getting there was really, it felt very surreal for the first couple of days. And I know also a lot of us were very stressed. And despite what the locals thought, we did not sleep so well on the first night. but yeah, overall, we were welcomed very warmly. And I think one thing that really was incredible was how quickly you adapt to your current surroundings. Like, I remember the first day, or first 2 days, I thought that this will not feel normal. But by day three, but day four, maybe you're showering with buckets and you're hanging out with the pigs and the chickens, and it feels like the most normal thing in the world. So it's really a beautiful thing, actually.
Yeah. And for you, how did the settling in go? Did you experience any difficulties, or was it similar to Jacob, to really like adapt and be welcomed there?
I think we felt very welcomed, actually, at least I did. And the people at the university were super kind. We were always given like snacks and coffee in the break. So that was really accommodating. But I think our experience was super different in a way. Obviously, you weren't in Thailand, I was in Uruguay, but also in the way that we lived, because we actually stayed in a hostel, and I stayed with like in one room with 9 other girls. So I had a completely different living experience. So it was also, well, I mean, maybe your like the houses that you lived in weren't so like didn't have such thick walls, but nor did my
you bed. You didn't even have walls.
Exactly, like my bed just had like very thin curtains, and there was even like a rim, so you couldn't really be alone ever, except if you went to the bathroom. But even then, you know, like there's only one bathroom for everyone.
Yeah.
In a way, surprisingly, that didn't actually take that much energy from me. Or at least that settling in went relatively smooth, but I just remember being so exhausted that first week, because it was this like overwhelming amount of new impressions. First being with all these people nonstop, being in like needing to make sure when to eat what, where to get what, because everything was also it was very expensive actually. And then also spending at least like 6-7 hours at university every day. So it was a very full day. But there were also a lot of breaks within those like these periods of time. So it was not only like complete day of studying, but more, oh, we start in the morning, then there's a bit of a break in between, we have some lunch. So it was super kind from them, but it still like weighed heavy on me, at least to kind of, okay, this is my new rhythm, I walk there, this is what I do, this is why I can go to grab some lunch, and all of these things. But I definitely had a very different settling in experience than you, because we didn't move around at all, like more than from one part of the city to the other.
And then when you had the first couple of days when you have found your rhythm, it always takes a while. But then did you experience any culture shocks, or how was the environment that you lived in? Like what did you feel when you were a bit more settled in?
Culture shocks per se? Well, in a way, yes. Like the time thing that I mentioned, and also how spontaneous and how like not soft, but more flexible people are. That was not necessarily in the beginning, but it was something that kind of became more clear over time for me, because for instance there was a miscommunication about like the structure of our research. So the university there didn't exactly know what we were supposed to do, but that's not the point I'm trying to make. But they ended up organizing interviews for us on the spot with like three key stakeholders, so very influential people. And we were told, oh, you have an interview with this and this person like the day after tomorrow. And we were like, huh? Like, couldn't you tell us that earlier? Like, we would have liked to prepare for that. Like, that was kind of our reaction. We didn't say it like that, but we thought that. And only afterwards, we were kind of told, hey, this was them reacting, like, on the spot, organizing that for you. So we kind of came in with our mindset, or I came in with that mindset of, well, if this is organized, like, this must have been known for, like, months. But apparently there's just way more flexibility in that way. Like, the people are very friendly, very approachable, and really want to engage with you. And, so these, like, kind of tiny behavioral things were more what I realized afterwards, or like towards the end rather than during the first couple days.
Okay.
Yeah, I can sort of comment on that as well. I also, again, as I think will be a recurring theme, had a very different experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my experience, the whole field trip was one big culture shock, positively and negatively. We have to remember that the people in the village didn't speak English, and they also didn't speak Thai, because they spoke an indigenous language called Pakenyaw.
Okay.
Which may seem meaningless because we don't speak Thai either, until you realize that Thai is on Google Translate, whereas Pakenyaw is not. So that makes it mm-hmm. more difficult, because there was literally no way for us to communicate at first. And we had to, through body language and learning by doing, sort of find a way to communicate with one another. And it worked very well for some people. Some people picked up a good conversational understanding of the language, actually. Others, including myself, less so, but focused more on like body language and talking through other means with their host families, because mm-hmm. We were all in separate host families.
Okay.
So we were actually very much integrated, in the sense of we were matching the local people's day-to-day schedules while mm-hmm. we're doing our research. I will say, if anyone is listening that is thinking about doing this field study in global studies, it's not for the faint of heart. It's very difficult in many times. You are very isolated from urban life, and you have to be aware that the safety net is frail. That shouldn't scare you, because it's also a very meaningful experience mm-hmm. to everyone who came. Like, it was, I don't know anyone who returned without having a genuinely impactful experience. But that is a word of warning, because it's a very intense experience. Once you're in the village, you're in the village, like
mm-hmm.
for 5 days until you're back in a city, because Chiang Mai and Bangkok are international cities. You can go to a 7-Eleven and get a Coca-Cola. That's not possible in the village. So in that sense, yeah. But to sort of go back to the lighter note, because I don't want to scare people, the people in the village are exceedingly friendly, exceedingly friendly. Like, they really made a big effort to welcome us. They had multiple talks with our supervisors about whether everyone feels comfortable, like what they can do to make our experience better. And that really shined through in the way that they treated us. So everyone that I know of, including myself, was treating exceedingly kindly with great hospitality, and it really made the experience.
Yeah. And what was then the landscape like around the village? Like, was it, like you said, it was rural, but rural here in the Netherlands is very different from rural in Thailand, probably.
Yeah. So if you look at the geography of Thailand, Chiang Mai and this village as well, name is Hoi Kang, was in the north, which is a very mountainous region. So when we were in the city in Chiang Mai, which is on a sort of a plateau, it was always very hot, but in the village at night, it actually got pretty cold because it was pretty far up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try sort of describing the landscape that you could see in the morning, because it was really quite incredible. You see the forests and the mountains stretch out for a long, long time. It's very isolated. Like I said, closest city is 3 hours by car, and you see rice fields. So those are the first two things that come out. You have very misty mountains and you have the rice fields. And it really is breathtaking. Like the sights the nature has a reputation for a reason, I'll say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, also like climate wise, it was very different from Bangkok, and you know, in the mountains, like the temperatures just shift. So mm-hmm. we had days that were very hot and nights that were very cold, but really like the landscape also at many points in the trip sort of took a central role in shaping our experience, because it's not like anything I'd ever seen before.
And for you, Montevideo, how did it look like? Was it different from European cities you've been to, or from cities in Brazil maybe?
Well, the first week was very gray, to be honest, because the weather was gray, yeah. And then everything seems kind of gray and bleak. And then when it's not nice out, the only people that you see on the streets, or like most people are like very secluded, are people who are either homeless or like kind of like going on the streets. So it also then feels completely different to when the sun comes out. So like, I do want to note that, but when the sun did come out in like week two, three, four, basically, it became super nice and very, well, I think I'd say Montevideo is a city with a very hidden charm. So I think I managed to find it and like, end of week three and four, like you discover new parts of the city, you discover like the city life. There's super many like tango bars, and there was a chess tournament in the main square. There's like a lot of events going on. There's a lot of city life in a way, but it's not so out in the open, I'd say, at least not to us. And in a way, we're also similar to tourists, right? Although we are there for a month, it's not like we live there and we know all the communication channels and we know where to find everything. But it's an extremely also cultured city, so there's like a lot of theaters, a lot of concerts. I went to like a national guitar contest that was just free to everyone, and then people were playing guitars. So like these kind of things are very prominent, but only if you look for them. So that is kind of a mixed view that I have on the city. But the city per se is not so beautiful, I'd say. I mean, to my eyes now, it has a lot of colonial monuments still, and a colonial architecture as well. So there's some recognizable, like for me, familiar architectural structures. But one thing that's really striking is that in Uruguay, the tango is very prominent, and there's even like this kind of fight where it originated, if it's from Argentina or from Uruguay. Like they're, you know, depending on who you ask, they'll tell you a different story.
Yeah.
But that also means that it, like, if it's good weather, and that's why the emphasis on the weather earlier, on Sundays there was always the square that we'd pass, and on that square the people that just like put on boxes with some like music, but it's like this old tango music that kind of sounds like it's coming from like a vinyl, and it kind of has this like cracking sound to it. And then nice. You kind of see a bunch of old people like taking their little chairs and making a circle and then dancing tango, but not in like an amateur way, but in like a super professional, some in suits, some not, but all of them really know how to dance. And I think that really illustrates the vibe of the city in a way, but only because you're not going to see this dance happening if you don't know where it is. So you're not going to like enjoy that moment if you're not there at the right time, because if you're there in the evening or if you're there on a different day, you might not see that. So that's what I kind of mean with the hidden charm, because it is there, but well,
you really have to go looking for it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there are some cities that are like that for sure. So
yeah.
Very nice that you managed to find the right places and the right time then as well.
Yeah, it was some work, but I managed.
And for you, did culture or like dances, music also play a role in the town or also in the city?
Yes, yeah, so we had some experiences with local music in the village as well. We learned, thankfully, because we had two interpreters for our interviews. Okay. They were both young, they were both locals, and they spoke English. So we learned a lot about the local culture through them and about music. In the cities, it's hard to say because Bangkok is a party city. It's not only a party city. I think it gets a bad reputation sometimes, but it definitely has that aspect to it. So you hear the same music there that you hear here. I wouldn't say it's like deeply culturally moving, but it's like, you know, Bangkok has a reputation. I'll leave it at that. Besides that, I must say I don't remember too much street music that was very like specifically Thai. There's a lot of street music. People in Thailand, they love to party, they love to dance, they love to make music. But what I heard way more was you'd have, in Chiang Mai especially, at every street corner, someone with a guitar playing blues songs from the 60s or playing a cover of the Scorpions or doing something, you know. But it was usually recognizable music for a Westerner.
And you were both there with a group of fellow students, which you already knew more or less well. How do you think that shaped the way you stayed there, you settled in, or also just your research? I would assume that going alone to such a place would be even more like difficult to do.
I think it definitely shaped the experience, but in both ways, like in a positive, not necessarily negative, but also kind of, it just shaped it in many ways, let's put it like that. Because we were staying in such an intimate environment in a hostel, we also put, as a group, a lot of effort into kind of getting to know each other relatively well before we actually went, because we just knew there's a lot of potential for conflict or for disagreements and discomfort if we don't talk about some things prior. So we did do that, and I think that helped a lot. And I think I can even say that there were no real conflicts or like big issues at any point. And I also think that we grew together as a group a lot and could support each other in what we're doing. And that made the experience definitely very fruitful. But I also think that because you're in such a big group and in our setting, because we were a big group of girls only, or women actually, that also kind of gives this whole safety dimension a different dynamic. Because obviously if then there's one or like, you want to be careful, you want to support each other and make sure that everybody is safe and doesn't, well, go somewhere alone or something like that. But it also makes it possible for kind of fear to spread quickly or people to get like extra nervous or to kind of hold each other back a little bit. Not that it is bad, because sometimes it's good if someone tells you, hey, maybe don't do that if that's not advisable from their position. But sometimes I think it's also good to let go of that. We need to do everything as a group. So that was a dynamic that we kind of encountered. In the beginning, we did everything very much together because we were, that's also maybe important to mention, we were in the, prior to going, very much warned of the, like, regarding safety aspects in Montevideo. And we were told, well, don't ever go anywhere alone, especially as a woman, that's not safe. And while that is true in some areas, and while you need to be careful, in my experience, the city feels extremely safe if you like take care and you share your location and you research before. Maybe don't go to the port area because that's where some gangs were, like last reported. So I think that kind of shaped how the dynamics worked. But I think we were able to let go of that at some point. But then that, of course, takes longer than shifting your own mindset around, because the entire group needs to kind of adapt to that. And you also, at least we did, you kind of fall in that rhythm of buying food together or like organizing that together. And sometimes that can also be limiting, because sometimes it's just nice to not eat the same food that now this person suggests. So these are kind of things that we not struggle with, but that shape the experience, but not necessarily in a negative way as well. Like, obviously there were also super nice moments together. We had a great time in between, and most of the time actually, we also did like some weekend trips together in different groups. So there was definitely a positive outcome from that side as well.
Yeah. And for you, did you experience things differently than your peers? Was it helpful to have people around?
Yeah, so I was with a very, very good group. I have to say, like, we really bonded over this trip. Mm-hmm. Everyone was really helping each other out in the difficult times and also enjoying together in the happy times. So I'm really grateful for that. Like, there are really some extraordinary people there. In terms of group dynamics, I mean, we were a pretty big group. We were 13 people. So that was gender-wise 2 guys and 11 women. In terms of sort of speaking to what Sophia mentioned about the safety aspect of the city, again, coming from the positionality here of a guy, because obviously I know it's very different depending on gender sometimes, but I felt exceedingly safe at all times, like both in Bangkok and in Chiang Mai, more so even the latter. Like, I was willing to and did walk around alone at night, and I never at once felt uneasy. So that said, there wasn't really much need for like group protection, mm-hmm. as far as I understood. However, we did still, you know, take the, you know, we weren't naive. We went places together, usually, like, had frequent communication in the chat, all those sort of things. But overall, like, thankfully, we didn't get into any situation where we were really reliant on the group for protection or safety. So I'm happy about that, of course. But yeah, it was just good to know to be with people that had your back. And yeah, overall, they shaped the experience in a very positive way.
Yeah, I agree. It was nice to, you know, like, I think it would have been a very different experience going on your own. And I mean, in a village, yeah. Certainly, but also for me, because then you don't have someone to bond over or who understands the current struggle that you have, or who you can also kind of like share your opinions of what is going on and kind of put into perspective, like, whatever you're thinking, because they understand the exact process that you're going through. Yeah. So it was definitely very nice.
It's nice, yeah, because you can also sort of, yeah, revel in that shared experience then a little bit. Because suddenly you're in the minority now. Like, oh, tables
exactly,
turned. Like,
exactly.
You're out of, like, in a village of 600 people, yeah. You are one of 13 that has gone to a European school and speaks English. Like,
it creates a very intense bond that also kind of, at least for the people that I went with, kind of remains after the field study. Well, of course, not in the same way, because we don't wake up in the same room every day. But, and obviously it also depends on person to person, but there is a kind of familiarity that I have with all of them, no matter how close we have grown, because, well, if you wake up in the same room for a month and like say hi to each other every day and at least have some kind of a conversation every second day, then of course there's the bond that creates.
Yeah, I agree. Same with us. I mean, we didn't wake up quite in the same room, but
same time, maybe.
Same time-ish. Yeah, I mean, you know, at one point, you know, the once those roosters start going, they don't stop. So we had our alarm clock set to the same time, if you know what I mean. But spending all day together in a foreign environment with that group of people, it creates a bond. And mm-hmm. I think it's also like, because we all went through this together, I think I must agree with Sophia, it adds a special sort of flavor to your mm-hmm. relationship with those people that you don't really get from other relationships. So yeah, it is a really wonderful thing, actually.
Mm. And you mentioned just now that you were kind of the minorities all of a sudden. Like, yeah. Can you maybe elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this goes for... It's very interesting because your position as a European changes very much in Thailand based on where in Thailand you are. So mm-hmm. in Bangkok, not to get, you know, too much into it, but there's a reputation for a certain kind of tourist that goes to Bangkok. There's a lot of Europeans in Bangkok. Most of them aren't researchers. So you're sort of looked upon, like there's an industry there for you, you know, like mm-hmm. you go there and there's people who approach you with, hey, do this, do that, like come to our shows, so that you're not unexpected there. Chiang Mai also attracts a lot of tourism, but it's more like, let's say, spiritual people who are interested in Buddhism, because it's a very old city with a lot of Buddhist temples, which, by the way, are beautiful and very worth seeing. So I'm not making fun of hippies here. Like, it's definitely something you should see. But it's a different type of tourism. And then Hoi Kang, like, does not have tourists, really. So your position changes, like, as you travel through the country, right? Like, you're seen very differently. Mm-hmm. That's sort of most of what I have to say about that. Like, you are generally in the minority. It's a very surreal experience if you've never had it before in your life. I've only had it once on a different trip. So also for, like, 3 weeks, maybe. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it definitely like changes your perspective a little bit, because you realize suddenly like, okay, it's also some things you realize of like, you are so accepted to this European norm as like, this is what is normal. And then everything else is like a derivative of that, mm-hmm. until you realize like a large part of the world, the majority of the world, lives very differently than we do. And suddenly you feel a little bit weird about some things.
Yeah, you do feel weird, right? Like it's a little yeah. realization of like, oh, okay, what I'm doing or what we're doing is not necessarily right.
Yeah, I have an example for this that's maybe a bit vulgar, but I think this is something that's really interesting to me, that like was one of my most like culture-defining moments in Thailand, mm-hmm. which is that Thailand, like many countries, in fact, most countries, doesn't really use toilet paper. They mm-hmm. have like little spray bidets. And at first I was like, my European self can't handle this. Like, what is this, you know? I was like, oh God, can't wait to get back to Europe. Within 2 days, I was converted, and I got to say, it's much better. And I get why most of the world does this, and I don't know why Europe doesn't. So it's things like that that you just sort of accept for all your life, and then you're like, wow, like, we Europeans are a wacky folk sometimes.
That's really interesting.
And you also, I could assume with the language barrier, it's even more of a feeling of like, oh, we're in this isolated bubble, and like, we cannot really communicate with the other people around us, right? Was that something that you experienced similar? I think you've started to learn some Spanish. Did you also feel a bit like secluded from the rest?
I think not to the same degree that you felt secluded, Jacob, because I understand a lot of Spanish, and I also speak some if I'm put in the context, and I was put in the context there, so I kind of forced myself. Mm-hmm. And I think around half the group also spoke or understand Spanish or took language classes as part of global studies. And one of our group members went to a Spanish high school, like Spanish spoken. So we did have some members who actually could communicate very easily with the people around us. And at the university, everything was translated for us. And our supervisor was also from Argentina, so she could also kind of help us with the language. And like, in a way, it's very different because, yes, like not speaking a language or speaking a language only to some extent excludes you from the society in a way, but it's also Spanish. So you can still translate it super easily. Like, you can scan something and it will give you that. And we all had access to internet because of SIM cards. So that was a challenge, yes, but not in the same, like, I didn't feel as excluded because I could hop into it, like, in that communication. But I do still think that we were very much seen as foreigners, not because of the language, but also how we behaved. I mean, you can identify tourists or foreigners very easily, I think. And although we've tried very hard to, mask that, obviously that never works. If you're a group of 10 people who wander around and then stand still and then try to orientate, like, you know, you do all the tricks and you try to hide, like, not look at the phone and follow the map very, like, oh, where do I need to go? Where is it? But you probably don't succeed. I think through that there is maybe I think I didn't see it as isolation, more of a kind of very visible, okay, I'm not from here and that's okay too, and I'm still trying to keep a curious mind. So that's kind of more what I took away from it, that I don't need to fit in, or that is not my goal, because I can never do that. I can never like now suddenly be Latin American and understand everything as someone actually from Uruguay would. So I can always just try to kind of step back and accept that my truth is not the only truth, and that I definitely don't know better than anyone who is from here.
Yeah. And you mentioned the point about communication. I don't know, did you have internet connection really in the village where you were?
Let me tell you, as a German, okay, this is the best internet connection I've ever had in my entire life, okay? Berlin has worse internet connection. I'm being entirely serious. Like, we had 5G data the whole time in the middle of the rainforest. It made me very angry, because when I was when I then traveled back home to Berlin and I had like 3G at best, I was a little bit upset. But no, we died, like, yeah, internet connection. The university gave us data, so that was more than enough that we needed. And so I was fully connected the whole time. Electricity was the bigger thing, because there weren't that many outlets.
Okay. And then how did you stay connected to your families back here, for instance? Did you communicate often, or was it something, okay, I'm fully immersed here?
Yeah, I got pretty lost in the immersion, I think. I could have communicated. Mm-hmm. It was definitely possible, but not as much, partially because of the time difference. Mm-hmm. We were also very busy. Mm-hmm. And when you're in that different of an environment, everything feels like it's happening so fast and so slow at the same time. You don't really stop and think, okay, I should send a photo to my mom, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe I should have, but...
I like the so fast and so slow at the same time. I can connect to that phrasing, because I was in contact with family and friends, but also way less than I'm here or in my day-to-day life, also because of time difference, and also because it feels kind of difficult to convey what you're living or like what you're experiencing in one text message. And yes, I did send photos to kind of say, hey, I'm still alive, and like I didn't disappear, but you know, you cannot say, hey, I did this and this and this and this, and this is how it made me feel, in like a, yeah, this is how I'm doing grandma message. So I kind of let go of that in a way.
Yeah. And you were both there for 1 month, so do you think that this 1 month, was it long, was it too fast?
It was, for me personally, it was long. Like, I thought at first that the time would fly, but a month is a month. It's a long time. And especially when it's a month of a bunch of new stuff happening to you and uncertainty and all this. Like, I will say very honestly, as much as I love the field study, I was ready to go home when we did. I know some people weren't. I was, though. For me, I was like, maybe even the day before, I was already like, okay, I'm ready. So I think a month is a nice time, because it's a lot, but answer your question directly, no, it did not fly by.
I think for me, it did in part. Well, there were certainly moments that felt like it was going to take forever, and like where I can understand your notion of wanting to go home. But towards the end specifically, I could imagine myself staying longer, maybe in a different context, maybe not in a room with 9 other people, but in my own apartment or like a hotel.
Maybe a nice hotel, yeah.
Exactly, with a shower that it can lock, or like my own toilet. So I could imagine staying longer, but I think that's also because towards the end of the third week, I need to really actively try to change the narrative around for me and do things that are fun and make it a worthwhile experience. We could do weekend trips, we could travel around the country, which also makes it difficult because you need to kind of decide, okay, what do I do, what do I not do, what do I feel safe with, how, or like, do I want to invest in that weekend trip? So these kind of questions I kind of sat down with myself and found strategies to make it very fun and interesting for me. It was still a good length, I think, because within a month you can do a lot. Yeah.
Okay, and was it something that you missed while you were there, like some from here, from your routines or something, that you're really like, okay, I can do this for a month, but afterwards I really, really want to get back to this?
I mean, to be honest, from the cities, no, not so much. There wasn't really anything. Like, the cities, especially Chiang Mai, always felt like a bit of a safe haven. In the village, like, there are certain urban luxuries that you're used to that after a month of being held back from, you do miss. So, like, running water, for example, and being able to drink out of the tap, and like accessibility to a wide transport net that could take you anywhere. Because when we were in the village, we were in the village. Like, we didn't go really anywhere unless one of the coordinators or one of the interpreters took us on a ride somewhere on the back of their car, which did happen, but it was really somewhat outside of our control. So those are the sort of things that I kind of missed. But I do want to return to Thailand one day and explore the cities a little bit more.
I think what I missed is this agency in many ways, like agency in preparing my own food. Well, I could do that there, but I did it in a hostel kitchen. Mm-hmm. And for the 10 people of us, we had like two cupboards and like one section in the fridge was just not a lot. And this was all publicly available for everyone in the hostel. So it happened quite a few times that the food that I had bought and like thought planned to eat the next day had just disappeared.
<It's gone. laughs>
And like the very nice bread I found somewhere was just gone. I even tried to hide it, but so these kind of things where I'm like, okay. I just go to my pantry and I take the pasta I bought and like I make myself like a nice meal. These are things I really did miss, and mm-hmm. also cutting on cutting boards that are not used by someone else. But these are very like details in a way, because you also have to take some compromises into account. And we did always have running water, although the water quality in Uruguay is also very challenging at the moment because they had lots of droughts, and generally like water is a big topic right now. So it always had to be filtered, so we also couldn't drink the tap water. But another thing that's connected to food is really interesting, because we were studying food insecurity as mm-hmm. well. And buying food in Uruguay is really an experience in a way that you really realize that everything is just so expensive. Mm-hmm. Also to compared to how I shop here in Maastricht, I paid way more. Oh. Because like 1 liter of oat milk, well, that's maybe my standard, because I don't drink milk with lactose, but that was like around €8 for 1 liter. And that is really high. So like these things I didn't have access to like that, but I like had prepared for that in advance, and I took like oat milk powder with me. So mm-hmm. these kind of things worked. But just going into a supermarket in the Netherlands was such a nice experience when I came back, because fruits and vegetables were also difficult to get a hand of, fresh and good ones, because they were also expensive and then usually not so high in quality or in taste. So I really realized, okay, the tomato passata that I'm buying there, like there were 5 different kinds, and I knew that the ones I bought were just not, like they didn't taste like much. Mm-hmm. And these kind of things, I don't know, I just realized how important it is for me to have food that tastes good. It's maybe like very superficial and a basic necessity to many, but I think I take a lot of joy from that. So that is something I missed. But that also shows, like, if this is one of the main things that I missed, that the rest was very much good. Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
If I can comment on the food really quickly, because I think I had the exact opposite experience, because wow, the food was tasty and wow, was it affordable. I mean, if you like food, I think Thailand is your country, because you get like some of the best meals you can imagine for basically nothing on European standards. Like I'll say I knew that there was going to be a price difference in my favor, and I budgeted for this trip a certain amount of money, and I already thought that was a bit slim, and I used maybe half of it. Like it was really, sorry, Sophia, I know I'm making you a little bit jealous here. But really, like, just especially local food. I mean, there's two things that are expensive in Thailand in my recollection, and that's alcohol and fast food.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So there's, I think maybe it's because of taxes, I'm not quite sure actually, but it's alcohol, fast food, like those the big chains that we all know here are the same price. Generally, like if you go to a local restaurant, the prices are very, very affordable for a European wallet. So that was very nice, and that's definitely something I miss.
Well, yeah, that's a completely different experience in a way.
It's dangerous. You get used to it very fast.
That would be lovely. No, that was very much not it, actually. Interestingly, organic shops were actually cheaper than supermarket chains, which I completely didn't expect, and that also took us a while to kind of figure out. But like the kind of shops where you buy things like not packaged, but where you weigh it yourself, those were fundamentally cheaper. But the reason for the high prices is also that Uruguay just imports a lot of their stuff. Like they basically only produce soy and cow meat, like making barbecue every weekend. And it's kind of a cultural event. Okay. We happened to attend such a barbecue event by accident. It was actually a cooking show of like a Uruguayan famous chef who gave cooking show and grilled like on the stage and explained how he like sauteed and sliced the meat of the something. And we got to try and it was really good. Yeah. So the culinary experience, yes, for meat eaters. And also, yes, if you are prepared to spend some money.
Mm.
Because obviously there are still good restaurants, but you also need to pay for them. Like, that is just a ratio. So maybe that's also a good place to put a warning for people who are considering Uruguay. Budget for it. Think about it. Like, look at the compare websites that show you what the prices are, but it's doable as well. If you think about it before and if you're prepared to spend some money, then you'll survive.
And maybe as an opposite then for this question, is there something that you missed when you came back here, like from your destinations?
I mean, besides the prices, obviously, yeah. And the fantastic internet quality. I think this is something I realized, like, especially in Thai cities, things have a way of just, and okay, this is, I'm going to preface this by saying, I'm a European tourist in a very privileged position in Thailand. So I don't know if this is the experience for the average Thai citizen, but things just have a way of working. Like, you just get from A to B, like with a tuk-tuk or a taxi or whatever, and it just works and you get your food. And like, there's not this, like, I feel like in Europe, like for me as a student, I'm so happy about like, oh yeah, Maastricht has all these international restaurants and this blah blah blah. I can afford none of it, you know, like it's just sort of like there's all these like spheres of inaccessibility in Europe depending on what social class you're in. Whereas for a European student budget, Thailand, you have full access to everything, and that goes beyond food, that goes to transportation. You can travel across the city, across the country, you can have all these great experiences, and yeah, these things just sort of work out. And it's something I miss. And again, very clearly, like the European conversion rates that are playing in my favor, but still.
I think what I miss, or maybe something I noticed that is very absent here, is that the easygoingness of life, or how important socializing is, and pausing and taking a moment and sharing and all of these tiny things. Like one example is mate drinking. It's a very intense caffeinated drink. It's made out of the mate plant. And you put the leaves in a specific cup and you pour first a bit of cold water at it for it to set, and then you carry these massive like thermos cans around with you, and whenever you feel like it, you pour a little sip of that water in your mate cup, and then you have a little specific straw that you drink it out of, and then you take a sip, and then you're also meant to share it with someone. So you'd make like, do you want some mate? And then you pass it on to the person next to you, and you just offer it like that. And that is such a ritual of like, like, I want to share this with you. This is like a common drink, although it's very much like this person's cup that they carry around them, that I think wouldn't be possible here, or is not seen here in a way that our culture or like this society is not really focused on sharing and interacting as much, I have the feeling. So whenever you're outside and like it's nice weather, people are just running around with their mate cups and walk like in a way that, but this is also in a way a very interesting example of something that doesn't happen here. Like people are very focused on practicality and comfort and like how can it be as effective as possible. But then you have the Uruguayans who have their mate cup in one hand and then this really big thermos can in their other, like this, it's like a big bottle with a handle, so it's very like massive, and that is really impractical for walking. I tried it because I also bought a cup and I have my own thermos can, and it's really not practical. Like I tried to hold it all in my hands, but that's just in a way a different way of life, and obviously you grow up with it and it's part of the culture and it's like an important like aspect of your day-to-day life. But to me it also shows that life is a bit slower. Like there's more focus on, you know, walking around with your mate cup and then drinking a sip and looking at the sunset and then going on.
Sounds really
but
nice.
Not in a like a, oh, I don't care about the world way, but in a, oh, I take it a bit slower and I'm more in the moment and more conscious. And I think that I miss. So like this notion is not something that's so present here.
I think Thailand has that a little bit as well. Although people in Thailand, they work a lot, especially in the village. Oh my God, like these work schedules are incredible. Like my host dad, he had like three jobs. Like the house was at a gas station, which he operated. He was also a teacher at the local district school. And he had a rice field, as everyone did in the village. And it was really like work 14 hours a day for him every day. So in that sense, but they do still take the time to enjoy everything that they do, which is really incredible. Mm-hmm. But it's actually an interesting thing also. This is something we talked about a little bit at the village, like, That's sort of a bit of a shift nowadays, where in Thailand you have a lot of high rates of depression actually that are increasing because people are just working so much. I mean, that's one of the reasons, among other, of course, but people, you know, they're like really, really hard workers, which is very commendable and I was very impressed, but also, yeah, at times, so it's a little bit of a contrast there, but generally there you do still have those attitudes every once in a while of like, okay, things are just sort of easy going, but you sort of see those two sides of that coin in Thailand.
Yeah, I also didn't want to say that people don't work hard at all. No,
of course, that's not what I meant to say with that. But it's just something I that I remembered based on what you said, yeah.
And I mean, you were there for months, so is this kind of like a tourist? But then you also did research there. How did you see yourself? Like, do you think it had been different if you had been there just for touristic purposes and not at all for any research?
Oh, for sure. I think definitely in many, many ways. Just, I think if I were a tourist, I would have not stayed in Montevideo, to be very honest, because I don't think I would have taken the time to get to know the city the way I did, because I like had a purpose there, because I stayed there for research, or like I had a program planned out for me, because had I been a tourist, I think I would have moved on. I would have explored the nature, the deeper like inside of the country, because I also did get to do that to some extent. I did a weekend trip to like a place more in the countryside, but I think that would have been more the focus, because that's really what's also striking to Uruguay. But I think it also kind of changed over the course of the trip, because towards the end I really did see the beauty of the city, or could see some of the beauties. But you can never really feel local, right? Like you can never say, oh, now I feel like a local, because I will never be. But I did feel more settled in a way that I, you know, I went to that one grocery shop now every week. I know it. I've been there. I start to recognize the aisles. I start to like know my way around. I know that I've eaten empanadas there and that I've got this and this there. I've been to that Sunday market. So these kind of things brought in a routine that I would have definitely not had I been a tourist, because usually, at least when I travel to places, I don't necessarily tend to go to the same places multiple times to re-experience them. But that is something that I did do during that time, because there's also some comfort, right, in kind of going to the same place or the where you've once already gotten good food, just to kind of keep that routine up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's very, very similar. Like, I think it would have been very different had I been a tourist. I mean, the very location of the field study, I don't think I would have even known about, and much less gone to a small rural village in the mountains. I wouldn't even know how to get there, right? Because, I mean, it's not like there's a train running. We took a bus, like a private bus. Mm-hmm. The whole destination, it would have been a very, very different experience. And I do intend to have that experience. I do intend to return to Thailand one day as a tourist, because I think there's just so much more to see. But I think that will be a very distinct experience, and will be less unique, even in a way.
Mm-hmm. And would you return back to the countryside as well, or focus more on the cities or a different region?
I would consider returning to the countryside. It's just the issue of accessibility, right? Like, you have to keep in mind that it's it really is like 2.5-3 hours away from Chiang Mai city, and we got there because we had people who organized it for us. If you asked me now, like, I have no idea who to contact. I would have no idea how to even get there. So it's an issue of accessibility, but in principle I would return. Maybe not spend that amount of time proportionally to my trip in the village, because I want to see more of the cities. But yeah, I also think it would be foolish to try to replicate the experience that I had as a researcher, because it's not going to be the same even if I revisit the village.
And for you, would you go back to Montevideo? I think your impressions are a bit mixed for that city.
No, well, I don't think I would go back to Montevideo. Maybe I'd stop by it if I'm like in Latin America for a longer time and in that area. I don't want to say that the city doesn't have anything and that it like is not a city worth visiting. That's not what I'm saying. But I think I just with that month have like not seen everything, but have exhausted all the different opportunities of what I find interesting or enriching. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's always way more than one is aware of, but I think I would be settled, but I would definitely go back to Buenos Aires, because, we did a weekend trip to Buenos Aires as an entire group, and that was just a very like mesmerizing and amazing experience, and in so many like eye-opening ways that contributed a lot to my understanding of Montevideo and also like the understanding of local culture at large, because, well, it's a different city in a different country, but it's still kind of puts it into perspective, because there's also a financial crisis there, and everything is relatively cheap. So there's a kind of an imbalance that you get to understand, although these countries are like super neighboring, like our neighbors. There's still a lot of disparities there. So that was super interesting. And that is a city that I think I would always be super willing to go back to. But I don't want to discourage people who are listening and considering going to Montevideo. It's also worth a visit. But just for my personal experience, I wouldn't go back necessarily as a tourist.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then as a final question. What would you say are your biggest takeaways from the whole experience, like 1 month in a very different country, on the other side of the world almost?
That's a hefty question.
Yeah.
I would say, for me, the biggest thing that changed was the world is simultaneously small and large. And I know that makes very little sense, but I think it's once you have that realization, at least for me, something clicked where I was like, okay, everyone, like we're all humans, we're all so connected. There's the things that we share are so, not just like in like a metaphysical, like, oh, you know, we all have the same descendants or blah, 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 but also in like a very cultural way. Like a lot of the things we do are just very similar. You know, we laugh, we blush, you know, we shake hands, and that's, you know, varies a little bit from culture to culture, but across the globe, it's the world is getting smaller in that sense. But it's also so different in so many ways. Like it's, you, there's so much to see, there's so much to explore, and you really, even the whatever seems like the most inaccessible place to you and the thing that seems like the most outlandish idea, like can become a reality within a couple of days, maybe even a couple of hours. I mean, if you told me prior to global studies you would be spending a month in a rural Thai village, I would say like, you insane, you know, like that was that's crazy. And not only that you would go there, but that you would like it, and that you would feel very like understood by the locals, like despite not speaking the same language or having the same cultural upbringing. So in that sense, I think that's my big takeaway. Like, I don't want to make some big claim on global citizenship here or call myself some like understander of the world, because I don't think I am. But it's just like I guess what takeaway, go out there, see the world, see the people, because there's cool things to see.
I think I can very much mirror what you're saying in the way, like, go out there and see it, because you will always get so much like, so many different perspectives just by being there and understanding either something new about the culture that you're visiting or about yourself. And I think for me, there were a lot of learnings that like are more connected to how I engage in groups and how I position myself in new surroundings and how I can make my experience a better experience. So I think my biggest learning in a way, or my biggest takeaway, was that the context that I'm in doesn't matter that much. Well, of course it matters, but it doesn't need to be the context that makes it enjoyable, but I can make it enjoyable for myself, if that makes sense. So I really had that realization at some point, and I think I mentioned that earlier already, that it, like, not everything needs to be organized perfectly, or I don't need to be handed everything on kind of a silver plate and I don't take it and enjoy it, but I can also change that plate around and kind of put things where I want and need them to be for it to be enjoyable for myself. And I think that is a tool, or like an understanding, that I'm really grateful that I got from that experience. That's something that I can always apply in every different setting, because I'm very sure I'll be in many settings that are maybe a bit more complex or more challenging than I thought, and then maybe I can adapt to them.
I think it makes sense. At least I hear a lot of my own experiences and what you just said. So,
but that's so interesting that we had like similar experiences, although the setting was so vastly different.
It was but that's, you know, small world, large world, you know.
That's a nice way to end that.
Yeah, I totally agree. So thank you so much, Jacob and Sophia, for being here today. It was really a pleasure to listen to your perspectives, and thank you also to our listeners for clicking on this episode by the Master Diplomat, and then stay tuned for episode 2.
This episode was written, recorded, and produced by Leanne Lichtenberger.